want to thank all of you. We have a treat coming up right now. We have Annette Bruce coming up. And before Annette gets here, though, I do want to tell you that today, that this has been storytelling time, a mishmash for anybody who had a story to tell. But Annette will be up here now from Eustis, and she is going to be our storyteller. While we're waiting for them, we're very happy to have you all with us and hope you can enjoy coming, keep coming back and see more storytellers come and enjoy every bit of the festival. Okay, Annette, go ahead.
She might want to get over there closer to that.
No, this is okay.
Fine, okay. Good morning. I'm Annette Bruce, and I'm a storyteller. I've been telling stories for most of my life. My mother and my father were storytellers before me. My mother often read me a story rather than telling me a story. And sometimes I would ask her to tell me a story when she was busy, and she would say, "I'll tell you a story about Mary Morey. Now my story's begun. I'll tell you another about her brother, and now my story's done." That would irritate me no end. I didn't want to hear any little old short jingle like that. I wanted to hear a real story. So I had to look up my father, but he was a yarner. I loved to hear him tell stories. And when I was little, I really thought that there was not as good a storyteller on the face of the earth as my father. And I just couldn't wait till I grew up and became a storyteller like he was. When I started school in Eustis, we didn't have any kindergarten, so I started right into the first grade. And I figured that if I was in the first grade, I was grown, and if I was grown, I was a storyteller. So I started telling my first grade teacher that I was a storyteller. She just smiled and patted me on the head, but I kept insisting that I was a storyteller. So one day she said, "Annette, you may come to the front of the class and tell a story." Well, when I got up in front of that class and saw all my peers peering at me instead of me being back there and looking up here, I got so scared and I said, "Mary, And she said, "There, there, Annette, take your seat. Maybe you'll do better next time." But there wasn't a next time. She didn't let me tell a story again. In fact, I was in the third grade before a teacher would let me tell a story again. But that time, I was so determined that I was going to do a really great job that I remembered to give them a nice little curtsy and a great big smile, and then I forgot the story. Now I remember it. Mary had a little goat. His fleece was white as cotton, and everywhere that Mary went, that goat went a-trotting. When I was in the fifth grade and my teacher asked me to tell a story, I said, "Mary had a little lamb. His fleece was as black as her hair, and everywhere that Mary went, they thought it was a bear." When I was in the seventh grade and my teacher asked me to tell a story, I said, "Mary had a lamb. Her father shot it dead. Now Mary takes it to school each day between two hunks of bread." When I was in high school and my teacher asked me to tell a story, I said, "Mary had a little lamb, colorblind, and so didn't know red from green or which was stop and go. Followed her to school one day, which was one more stupid thing to do. Got caught between the red and green, and now it's mutton stew." When I went to college and my teacher asked me to tell a story, I said, "Mary had a little lamb. His fleece was white as snow. And everywhere that Mary went, the lamb was sure to go." And now that I'm a storyteller, I like the little lamb tale so much that I tell it as my autograph story or theme story. And I tell it each time that I'm introduced as a storyteller, and I tell it this way. Mary had a little lamb. I told you that before, but did you know that she passed her plate and asked for more? There had a little lamp. From the time I was 2 years old until I was in the fourth grade, I lived way out in the woods in a house that we called a sandbed house. That was because it's Sandy Road going out to it, and there was sand all around the yard. It was a great big house with a wraparound porch and a fireplace in every room, but we had no indoor plumbing. And one night, when my older sister and brother, one of them were supposed to take out the chamber pots in the morning and the other was bring them in, and they'd forgotten to do it. And they said, oh, but they were afraid to go out after dark. My father tried to shame them into it and said, Annette's not afraid. I was 10 years younger than they were. And I said, oh, no, I'm not afraid. And so they said, well, let her go do it then. And so they went to get the lantern for me to take out there and found out that it didn't have any kerosene oil in it. And so instead of trying to pour some from one of the lamps, we were out, evidently, they took a lamp that didn't have a shade or a glass globe on it and then lit that and turned the wick up way up high, so I had quite a flame and I started out there. I don't know what caused me to jerk it up. I guess there was it was the scream, but I don't remember the scream at all. But I can still remember, still feel the hot breath of that animal on the back of my neck and his soft fur as he brushed past my cheek. He jumped from behind me, and my father and mother came running out there. He blew out the lamp, and evidently I'd done like that and burned him. And my mother and father came running out there, and they insisted that I screamed, and I kept saying, no, I didn't scream. And they thought that I just didn't want to admit it because I didn't want to admit that I was scared. But I kept insisting I didn't scream. It was several years later before I found out that a Florida panther, when it's stalking its prey, often screams and sounds very much like a woman screaming. And they tracked this animal down the next day and found a large, sorry to say, they killed it, a large Florida panther. And we had chickens and rabbits and other things back there, and that was where I was going back there, and I imagine he was back there after his supper. Which all reminds me of a story that happened when Daytona was just a small settlement and railroad hadn't gotten down to Ormond Beach yet. It was right after the Civil War, and as usual, drifters come into Florida after a war. And at this particular time there in Ormond, or close to Daytona, there was a man by the name of John McCormick. And he was washed out to sea and drowned, left his widow and his beautiful daughter, Hannah, who was still very young at the time. And they lived on in the sturdy cabin that overlooked the Halifax River. And they were very industrious people and very friendly and good. So the people in Daytona was glad to claim them for their own, even though they lived quite a ways down the river. Now, Hannah McCormick was beautiful in body and in spirit. She was just a real sweet person. And so, and Widow McCormick was very industrious and very innovative. Who else but a woman of her caliber would have thought of using the good parts of a used bed sheet to replace the rusted out screens on the windows? She took those good parts and tacked them on the frame, and it worked fine. It let the ocean breeze in and kept the bugs out, the insects out. Of course, it did somewhat block their view in the daytime, but they spent very little time in that cabin anyhow in the daytime. Among the people that came down after Christmas down into Florida, there was a certain one that came into Daytona and down to Ormond who was named Sneaky Sam. Now, here was a man who had earned his title. Sneaky Sam hadn't been there but a few days when he saw the most beautiful lady he had ever seen in his life selling Christmas greenery and herbs and spices. So he asked around to find out who it was, and they told her that it was told him it was this Hannah, the unmarried daughter of Widow McCormick. Well, he decided right then and there that he was going to have that girl for his own. That night, he borrowed a boat and floated down the river to the McCormick cabin. As he stepped up on the yard, in the yard, he heard Widow McCormick, and she seemed to be having her evening devotions. She was asking God's blessing on all the sick and afflicted and thanking him for all of her blessings. And then she said, "Dear Lord, my needs are very few. You have seen fit to take John, but you have given me Hannah, a beautiful daughter that has been a balm to my soul. All that I ask of you now is that you send a man that will love and take care of her. I want you to choose him because I will not be here very much longer. I'm getting old." And old Sneaky Sam wasn't about to let anything like that pass him by. He looked around and saw an empty water barrel right close by. He jumped in it, and a booming voice says, "Willow McCormick, I have heard your prayers and seen your good works, and I will answer them accordingly. On Christmas Day, there will be a man riding a white horse. He has come to get your daughter. He's the one I have chosen for her husband." Well, the McCormicks were excited. They would have loved to just run into Daytona and told everybody, but they didn't have time because they had to get decorated for Christmas and ready for their guest. So they cleaned house, hung Christmas greenery, and cooked all the food they could fix. Got everything all ready. And as for Sneaky Sam, well, he thought he had played it pretty cool until he got to thinking that he didn't own a white horse. And furthermore, he couldn't find anyone who did, that he could beg, borrow, or steal it. But he wasn't to be outdone, and so Christmas morning he got up and borrowed somebody's clothes to go get married in, someone else's buckboard to bring his bride home with on, and whitewashed his old nag. Now, whitewash is kind of a paint that's made with a lime base, and it stays on pretty good if it gets dry good before it gets wet, but it takes several days for it to set up, really. It dries kind of quickly, but it'll wash off fairly easily at first. But the horse looked pretty good when he arrived out there at the McCormick place, and the McCormicks asked him in and greeted him as one that had been sent from God. And Hannah was a wee bit disappointed. She didn't like his looks, and she didn't like him at all. And then she thought, "Oh dear, I being an ingrate, God has chosen him for my husband. I must appreciate him." And as far as Sneaky Sam, he wasn't wanting to push his luck too far. So right away he told him that he was the man God had told to come out there and take Hannah as his wife. So Widow McCormick wanted to send for the parson. And he said, "Oh, no use in that at all. Since why should we have some man come mumble a few words? We're married in God's sight, and that's all that's necessary." Well, Widow McCormick was a prudent woman, and she didn't much like the idea of doing that, but she thought, well, God does work in strange and mysterious ways. And so she went around the house picking up different things that she could do without, extra quilts and blankets and candles, anything that she had, that she had two of them or that she thought she wouldn't use for a while. And she was putting it into a large bamboo chest. It was a very strong bamboo chest that John had found washed up on the beach the day that Hannah was born. And they had always considered it would be her hope chest. So she loaded all this stuff into this strong bamboo chest, and they put it on the buckboard and started out. Well, Sneaky Sam thought he'd pull one pretty smart, and he felt pretty good about it. And so he kind of started rushing his old horse, his old nag, and it was a Christmas day like we have sometimes that was hot and humid like it is today. You know how it'll be hot on Christmas Day and then be cold in March. But it was a hot day, and that old nag started sweating. That was something he hadn't figured on, because he started sweating off that whitewash. Hannah didn't say a word, but he knew that Hannah was no one's fool. And he got to thinking how all those people in Daytona thought so much of Hannah and her mother. And he got to thinking, too, about how that old lean-to shack he was taking her to, how dirty it was. And he got to thinking, you know, if I get into Daytona And those people see her, and she happens to call foul. Those people in Daytona will tar and feather me and ride me out of town on a greased pole. So he thought, I better rethink this thing. So he said to her, put his arm around Hannah's shoulders and said, Hannah, dear, I have a gift for you, but it's most necessary for you to have your eyes closed when I give it to you. And she said, all right. So she closed her eyes. He said, oh no, that's not going to work, because it's so important for you to have your eyes closed when I give you this gift, and you might just forget and open them. Here, let me just take these things out of this chest here, and you get in the chest, and I'll close it up till I get the gift, and then I'll open it. And she obediently crawled into the chest, and as quickly as he could, he slammed that lid down, locked it, pulled the chest off by the side of the trail, and took off into town. He went by the store, which was open on Christmas Day, which wouldn't be today, but it was then, and got a lock and some nails. He went out to his old lean-up building, house, and he nailed the back door closed and both the windows, and then he took a nail keg and climbed up and put that lock way up high on the inside of the door, where you couldn't reach it without stepping up on something. And then he returned his borrowed clothes and told everybody that he was married and that he would be bringing his bride home that evening, and that she was a little excitable, and it might be that she might scream or holler, and if she did, not to pay any attention to it, because she'd calm down in a day or two and it'd be perfectly all right. So if you will just do me the favor of turning a deaf ear to anything that you hear coming from my cabin. And so he was getting himself all ready. In the meantime, Hannah was out there by that trail, locked up in that chest. But it happened that a nobleman, both by birth and by character, was on his way back to St. Augustine. He'd been on a hunting trip down in that section of Florida. And as he was going back, he saw that large chest there, and it intrigued him. And he asked one of his servants to go over and open it and see what it was, to investigate it. So he went over and opened the lid. And when that nobleman saw that beautiful Hannah, he thought he must be seeing an angel. He rubbed his eyes and looked again. And when Hannah looked at him sitting up there on his white horse, she knew God had kept his promise. So she got up and started telling him how an impostor had come and tried to, in like a wolf in sheep's clothing, and had tried to take her away. And he says, well, he should be rewarded for all this work. And so he told one of the men to go back down there to the cage where there was a Florida panther caught. And he says, bring it. And he put it in the chest, locked it up, and he and Hannah and his party went back to Hannah's house. There they were properly married, and Hannah, he insisted that Hannah and her mother go with them to St. Augustine. So it was several days later when a very happy wedding party got into St. Augustine. And as for Sneaky Sam, well, he got through with all this. He went back out there. It was almost dark. He loaded that chest down on the buckboard and drove back into town. He put up the horse, took that chest into that room, and got up on his nail keg and locked that door. Then he kicked the nail keg away, and then he went over and opened that lid. Now, the neighbors said they did hear a lot of screaming and yelling, and that some of the yells or calls for help sounded more masculine than it did feminine. But they were good neighbors, and they did exactly what Sneaky Sam had asked. They turned a deaf ear to all the sound from Sam's hiding place. Thank you. Thought it was appropriate that we have a short story here to wind up with, about a man who was born up in this area. In fact, he could have been born right in this place. It was somewhere close to Lake City. His name was Jacob Sutherland. By the time he was 7 years old, he could ride a horse and crack a whip. And he continued to do that, and he made himself a millionaire by the time he was 40. I'm not going to tell you much about him, There's a lot of interesting things about it, but I just want to share with you an ode to Cracker Jake, and it goes like this.
All day I face the barren wastes without the taste of water, cool water. Old Dan and I, with throats burned dry and souls that cry for water, cool, clear water.
We were 2 days out of Homosassa, making our way to Ponarasa, driving a midsummer cattle run beneath Florida's hard, burgeoning sun. The heat and the mosquitoes were just two of our woes, for we were thirsty clean down to our toes. As we dogged on under a cloudless sky, we found that even gator holes were dry. Hope was fading for our cattle, horses, and men, when right there before our eyes was a holding pen. And on the edge of a nearby cypress head was a water pump painted red. When the men saw it, they started to cuss, for they figured that the devil was just mocking us. But Slim started reading a note tacked nearby. Drover, if it hadn't rained, I know you're dry. I'm Cracker Jay, and I give you my word, there's water below for you and your herd. There's water in a jug to prime the pump, buried on the north side of the old hollow stump. Now don't you go drinking it or you'll never survive, because you've got to prime this pump to stay alive. So we dug up that jug and uncorked it right then. We were so tempted to drink it that it was a sin. But Slim continued to read the king's closing words. Water yourself. Water your herds. So we poured that water in and worked that handle with gust. First we heard a gurgling, and then out came a stream of rust. But a few more strokes and the water ran clear. It quenched our thirst and it quieted our fear. We thanked our Creator and we thanked Cracker Jake, for now we could make it to that freshwater lake. Slim called out to listen up to what he had to say, for the king's closing words we must obey. Refill the jug and bury it for others' sake. Thank you kindly, and the note signed, Cracker Jake. Well, we refilled that jug and buried it for others' sake, and we're still rounding them up and moving them out, thanks to Cracker Jake.
The night's so cool. Stars are blue, water, blue, water. But with the dawn, I wake and yawn and carry on to water.
Thank you, Jamie. Stand up and take a bow. Thank you.
Thank you, Annette. And that was Annette Bruce from Eustis.
And Jamie Green.
And Jamie Green.
New Mattel.
Yes. We are so happy to have all of you with us today. My friends call me Aunt Peggy. I'm from Jacksonville, and I am a storyteller. I go all over the state telling stories, as most of the storytellers do that come up here. We're so happy to have all of you here today, and we are celebrating at this folk festival Cousin Thelma Bolton. And some of you may remember Cousin Thelma was director of the Florida Folk Festival for many, many years. And the dress I'm wearing is one that she wore when she was telling stories. So I feel very happy to be a part, feel like as if I'm a part of Cousin Thelma. We have another storyteller coming up in about 5 minutes. Before she comes up, I thought I would tell you a teeny tiny true story from Cousin Thelma. Cousin Thelma said, when she was growing up as a little girl, they had a desk. And that all of a sudden one night, they started hearing a knocking sound. They looked all over the house and couldn't find where the sound was coming from. But it kept bothering them because they would keep hearing this knock. Finally, her daddy decided he would go over. He kept listening and listening, and it went to the desk. He opened the desk. There was nothing in it. The knocking had stopped. He closed the desk. When he walked away, the knocking started up all over again. And they began calling that ghost, that there was something in the desk causing it to knock. And she said that they believed it was a ghost in their desk, and they called him Old Knocker. And that is a true story from Cousin Thelma. That is one of her true stories. Very quickly, for some of you who are new in here, we've got a couple of minutes. Let me tell you about little old Jack. Jack's mama gave him a brand new suit of clothes. And he put it on, and she said, "Now, Jack, go to the store and take this to the man. But on the way back, don't you let no rain get on your clothes." "No, ma'am, mama, I won't let no rain get on my clothes." And then just as he was getting ready to go home, he started throwing stones over the water. And about that time, it got hot, real hot and cloudy, dark, dark as night. He looked up, he says, "I think it's a fixing to rain. It's a fixing to rain. I gotta hide somewhere." All of a sudden, he decided where he was gonna hide. He took a running jump and jumped right into the water. He hid under that water, took his hat off and hid that under the water. And he got home after it stopped raining. He went slishy sloshing home. And Mama said, "Jack, look at you. You done what I told you not to do." I said, "Jack, don't you get wet." He said, "No, ma'am, Mama." "You said, Jack, don't let the rain get on your clothes." And Mama, it did. Because I hid under the water. And that was the end of it.